there's been a bit of a debate recently about is worker representation on the boards of multinational corporations a good thing? You know, on the boards of big corporations.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, great. Yeah, they can fight for sort of better things for the workers. But I think there's a danger. There's a real danger of giving the corporate sector legitimacy.
Mm,
they can point at him and they say, look, we've got workers on our boards. And they're not going to give workers real power. And it's going to be tokenism. And they're still going to be there extracting wealth and concentrating wealth in very few hands, which then overflows into the political system and corrupts.
It doesn't change the fundamentals of the business model. It can kind of soften the edges.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. That softening can then weaken your goal at trying to reform the real, you know, rotten core.
Yes.
Because they're like, oh, look, the edges are all fluffy and nice. And you're like, well, what about the core? And like, oh, but well, you know, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those. It's always one of those big battles. Is do you fight for kind of some kind of incremental change that is better? So it is better to have workers on boards than not. But is it worth it if it takes away from what you actually want, which is kind of a reorganization of kind of enterprise more generally and the purpose and all of this, you know?
Yeah.
So and that's always a big struggle, I think, with some of the stuff that we do at NEF is where you try to be big picture. Yeah, it's always this incremental versus the kind of the revolution.
It's a really tricky one. I looked up solidarity economy on Wikipedia, and it says there are two schools of thought. One sees the solidarity economy as a replacement for capitalism, and the other school sees the solidarity economy as a way of humanizing capitalism. But those two things don't really work together at all. They're pulling in completely different directions.
You see that with a lot of the reforms. You know, I think you can see the same tension within, you know, universal basic income or something like that. Some people see it as the revolutionary change, or at least the step that leads to emancipation and no longer work slavery. And then, you know, equally forcefully argued can be, well, this is actually what maintains the dominance of the system. And a lot, you know, so I think we're getting to a lot of those kind of fundamental reforms that you can see through two different lenses.
Yeah.
And that makes it even more confusing for, you know, us working for the, you know, the future that we want to see. Where do we put our energy? What are the right fights?
I was recently asked to do a public debate to give the anti-capitalist stance. There was a pro-capitalist speaker.
Uh-huh.
And it was 50 people upstairs in a pub. It was quite raucous and it was very interesting. Halfway through the debate, turns out he's involved with a community energy scheme and a community supported agriculture scheme. I'm like, okay. So let's not argue anymore. if that's what you support, then I'm completely on your side. Let's not argue anymore.
Yeah. I mean, that's why sometimes I find it amusing when, you know, you can be goaded for, you know, capitalism is such a big umbrella now. You know that it keeps people like that it's all about this kind of agriculture. So it's to be just anti-capitalist, I think, is a bit of a blunt.
Yes, very blunt.
Targeted, but yeah.
I don't want to be anti anything anymore, really. It's a bad position to start from. Let's just be pro solidarity economy or new economy.
Exactly. I agree.
Yeah. Let's see how big we can grow it. Oh, that was his argument. He said, yes, but that's not gonna replace the entire economy. Said, well, when do you want it to stop? At what point do you want it to say, that's enough, we don't want to grow it anymore? There is no point. Let's keep growing it. See what happens.
Yeah.
Well, we ended up, you know, okay, fair enough. Let's do that.
Well, those are always interesting panels there, where you're brought on to kind of object to each other's positions and you end up finding a nice middle ground.
So let's talk about platform co-ops.
Yes.
I'm recording this, so I don't have to take any notes. Okay. I'll just send you a transcript when I've done it. I can talk to you about other things afterwards, but yeah, let's talk about platform. So on the low impact site, there are 220 different topics in various different sections. One of those sections is economy. And so this one is going to go into the economy section.
Great.
Then I will acknowledge you and link through to NEF at the bottom. And yeah.
Okay. And so super.
Every topic introduction is split into three parts. The first part is definition. What is it? The second part is what are the benefits?
Mm-hmm.
And the third part is what can I do?
Okay.
So, so to start off with the definition part, what's a platform co-op?
Well, a platform co-op is basically, at its most fundamental, is a platform-based business that is owned and controlled by its members and is formalized into a cooperative. So that can take many forms. You can get where it's mainly the workers. So you can get kind of worker-owned platform co-ops. But probably at the most exciting cutting edge, and also acknowledging the nature of the platform as a two-sided beast, is really that, you know, I believe that platform co-op should be multi-stakeholder platforms, which have space not just for the workers, but also for the customers, as they would traditionally be known, but the users of the service. So in the Uber model, or the rideshare model, which is the one that I'm certainly most familiar with, most of the models talk about the drivers taking control and being the owners of this platform. One that we're trying to push seeks to have drivers, but also users of the platform, be members. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to have the same rights in terms of governance, profit share. You can have different tiers of membership, but we believe that because both contribute to the value of the platform, that both should be acknowledged as members and owners of the company.
I suppose if the customers are part owners of the platform as well, that's going to encourage them to use it more.
Well, exactly. And also, I think, you know, possibly the one kind of downside that I feel sometimes happens with co-ops is that they become a bit kind of looking in, you know, because what co-ops do great is they force people to think beyond just short-term profit. That's really, really important. But they reroute that focus on thinking about the members. Mm. And so if members come from one very particular group with one very particular set of interests, you can kind of entrench those interests inside the company. That's not necessarily what I think is best for kind of the wider community.
They lose sight.
Yeah. So in fact, you know, and it's both, you know, a good feature and certainly a great challenge, because co-ops generally have functioned best when you have that kind of homogeneity of membership. So, you know, the big examples that have grown big are fruit growers, collectives, you know, these kind of things. Everybody's basically doing the same thing, growing fruit, and everybody wants the same thing out of the co-op, the best market price for their fruit possible. And when you start getting a much messier system, like a lot of the modern day platforms are, where you have not only the kind of the producer group are a much more diverse set. So again, if I talk about the ride hail, drivers come from all different kinds of backgrounds, different communities, different ethnic communities, different religious communities, different social classes, different races. And therefore you bring with it a much wider kind of outlook, much wider group of interests. But at least they're circled around, you know, better rights. So there's kind of some homogeneity of interest there within the drivers. But add users in, you'll suddenly have almost two user groups that are slightly in conflict. You know, users you could potentially see as wanting to have their fares reduced as much as possible, drivers increased as much as possible. So you're kind of creating this conflict in the governance. Now, ultimately, if you can resolve those well, you've got an organization that's really much stronger because you've got this agreement between these two core groups. But it also brings about potentials for governance challenges to kind of overcome. But yeah.
And what's ride hail? Tell me some more about ride hail.
Well, ride hail is just the kind of the coverall for where you have an app and you use the app to kind of hail a ride, to hail a taxi. So the Ubers, you know, they fall into that kind of wider category.
Okay. So is there a platform co-op to do that? Is there a platform co-op that is potentially challenging Uber?
Yeah. So this is the one that I'm working on at the moment. So we are getting towards the end of the business plan. We were hoping to launch in London, but we did a little crowdfunder to raise the money to so that I could basically employ some Uber drivers along with myself to build the business plan. As we did the crowdfunder, basically TfL changed the licensing conditions. So it used to be £2,500 to get a five-year license as an operator. And TfL changed that as we were doing the crowdfunding to £2.5 million.
Oh,
for a five-year license. And so as a cooperative with no track record and you know, low kind of returns for investors, we could never hope to raise the 2.5 million yeah. necessary just to get the license. It was probably 5 or 6 million to actually launch the service.
So when I went to TfL and I said, do you understand that the way you've structured this new license, in fact, basically cements Uber's dominant position here and makes it impossible for any company that is not basically operating the Uber business model, highly capitalized, highly extractive, to come into London. You basically banned everybody else from doing it.
They didn't know.
The TfL were like, oh wow, we never, ever, ever thought
of that. Oh, so it's not through malice or corruption, it's just through ignorance.
Some people don't take that at face, but I think, you know, they generally, what they saw at TfL was, wow, this company has come into London, is causing us a huge amount of extra work because they're trying to avoid all of our regulations. Their drivers are working too long, you know, in unlicensed, all this kind of stuff. Their compliance costs were going through the roof. And all they were thinking is, we need to charge Uber appropriately for the work that they're creating for us.
Yeah.
And to differentiate also, because basically the £2,500 got you the same license if you had 10 cars as if you had 40,000 cars.
Yeah.
So they also wanted to create that, you know, Sam's cars that I used down the road in Clapton was paying less than Uber. So from their sense, it was totally logical.
Yeah.
They were there, you know, charging more to the worst offender. But what they didn't realize was the ramifications. And it was the same with the GLA. I went to see, you know, both members of the transport committee at the GLA and a few other members. Oh, really? Oh, wow. We never realized that. We would love to encourage
you. Oh, right. So they could be on board as long as they understand the issues.
Yeah. No. So, I mean, you know, we didn't pursue it hugely because, the thought of trying to change the licensing requirements through the GLA, you know, is a couple of years work. And, you know, we wanted to do something now. But I think regulators are warmish to differentiating kind of costs depending on size.
Oh, fantastic.
The problem is that it requires a lot of effort. So it requires effort, first of all, to educate your politicians and then to kind of work it through the process, which is, you know, a couple of years. But what I certainly got from talking to the transport committee at the GLA and the TfL is that, you know, if we were willing to put the effort in, they would be amenable to creating a kind of social license kind of thing, which would be much, much less. And provided we didn't generate profit or distributed all the profit to members and things like that, and a few other criteria, that so definitely something we can talk about at the March meeting. I think that it would be people are, you know, I like to try and think the best of people most of the time. I do think that they really do want to encourage the kind of things that we work on. They are just hear much, much more from corporate interests, business interests, and not enough from people like us. Give them the right arguments, make it make sense. And I really believe they do, you know, they do get it and would like things to be different. But we, you know, they're so overworked like everybody else that, you know, you need to really hold their hands. And whereas industry has the money to pay people to hold their hands, like, it's harder for us to find the time and the effort and the energy to, you know, to really walk.
That's really actually quite encouraging that it's more to do with ignorance than corruption.
I think so. So we have to kind of abandon London temporarily. And now we're going to try and launch in Brighton. So Brighton also banned Uber, but have a political climate that's much more favourable to kind of radical, interesting business models. And, you know, so we've been working the kind of the local support there. And as I say, we're just finishing the business model. Then we have to raise a much smaller amount of capital. And hopefully we'll be starting, you know, the real work in 2019 to make it a reality.
I'll promote you like mad if there's an alternative to Uber.
Yeah, well, it would be really exciting. And you know, and it, I think that's one of the interesting things about this platform co-op notion is that, you know, it's been one of the most exciting buzzwords since, you know, Nathan, you know, coined it, what was it, four years ago now. I think one of the things that has most perplexed me is why we just don't see any out there.
So there are none that you can go to now.
I mean, the one that I know that's starting up soonest is one called the Equal Care Co-op, which is going to be doing social care. It's through a platform cooperative. But no, in the UK for the moment, as far as I know, there are no platform co-ops in existence that I'm aware of.
Are there any in any other countries?
Yes, I mean, the US has a few. So the US has some really exciting ones. So the one that I reference probably the most is called Up and Go. So Up and Go is the New York-based one around nursing and kind of at-home care. Around cleaning. And again, there with the support of the unions, they now have a relatively decent-sized platform co-op that you can use in New York for cleaning. There are a few others kind of that are bordering on the kind of platform co-ops in the kind of transportation sector as well. But I'm not sure whether they're fully registered as a co-op. So yes, I think the problem has definitely been is turning this great idea, which is absolutely fantastic, which is that, you know, so much of the damage that traditional platforms do at a theoretical level are mitigated, counteracted, neutralized by encasing it in the cooperative model. And that was a great insight from, you know, Nathan and co. The difficulty has certainly been in setting them up. And I think, you know, there's a few different reasons for that. And there are a couple of different factors as to whether I think a platform co-op's a goer or not. So the first one, the biggest one is there already a dominant, highly capitalized platform in there? So it's much harder to go in and do taxis, food delivery, accommodation, you know, all of these kind of ones where you have a unicorn already in there dominating the place. They've got really, really deep pockets. Anybody that comes in that tries to compete, they just outspend you. So that's definitely one of the challenges when you're thinking about which sectors are appropriate for disruption and which sectors are appropriate for platform co-ops to emerge is there already a dominant one? Mm. The second one that I think is then really, really important is what do the users of the platform think about it today? So why I think Emma and the Equal Care Co-op is such a great idea and such a great opportunity is that social care at the moment, the providers of care, they know that the current system is broken. They get paid below minimum wage, they don't have enough time to care for the people that they want to. They are looking for something else that both respects them, pays them properly. The receivers of care are also know that the system is broken. The system costs a lot. When people come, they don't have the right amount of time to care and to really be with them. And so what you have here is both sides of the equation are looking for something new. And so provide them that alternative that offers that additional rights of the producer, that gives people an input into the governance and how the system works, that promises a kind of vision of the service but run properly with people at its center rather than profit. That's why I think, you know, so places where you have both sides of the equation today unhappy, great place. And again, social care, no big, highly capitalized American unicorn in there, you know, battling for it. That's why I think social care's got a really great idea. Then you've got, so Uber, for instance, the drivers, even the drivers that earn quite well from it, and so the two drivers that work with me on the project, you know, they earn between 15 and 18 pounds an hour because they know the system, they know how it works, they're intelligent guys. You know, it's certainly not the flexible work that Uber promise. You know, they have to work very fixed hours when the job is there, when the work is there, and so on. But they, all the drivers fundamentally understand the nature of the relationship they're in with Uber. Uber's the boss. They have, very little recourse. You know, if the app doesn't turn on in the morning, there's no technical support, no help. And that's basically your livelihood gone for the day until the app just miraculously starts to work again.
And they take 25% of the value of the work that you've done.
Absolutely. And that percentage is increasing. So, you know, when my drivers first started, it was 15%. They're now on 20% because it takes a while longer to kind of churn the old contracts. But new drivers now, a lot of them are getting on at 30 and things like that. Because ultimately, yes, it's, you know, Uber have been losing, you know, last year they lost, $4.6 billion in one financial year. But ultimately, they're going to need to recoup that money. And the whole issue of monopolies is, yes, it's a great ride while companies are competing for that monopoly position.
Yeah.
But once they become the monopoly, they need to recoup all of that. And so ultimately, we're all going to pay. So, yes, yeah, so the drivers, they understand that there's this exploitative nature. Offer them an alternative that says, look, we want to put you at the center. We want to put drivers' rights at the center. We want to give you a stake in the governance, but also a share of the profit. You've got the drivers pretty quickly. Yeah. Although they are skeptical whether you can compete against Uber, but they like the idea. And also, drivers can run multiple apps at the same time.
There must be a financial benefit. Co-ops don't have to extract 30% to send somewhere else. They can keep it inside the Absolutely. Organization. That must be a massive.
We believe that you can run it operationally on 5%. So you don't have to take 5% from the drivers
for the running of the entire.
Exactly. So you've still got to run technology. You've still got to have some sort of support system. You've still got to run a mini office. Yeah. But we believe somewhere between 5%, we might hedge at 10% just to be a little bit safe initially. But we think you can get, that low and be, indeed there's a kind of an ethical French company called Rox, who aren't quite setting up as a platform co-op, but have ethics and drivers right at their center. They're taking just 3% from the driver's fare. So, you get the drivers pretty quickly. And indeed, the problem with the Uber model are the users. Now, talk to a user of Uber in London. This is the best thing that happened to them. Being around London used to be this pain. I used to have to take a bus and then take a tube and had to wait with other people. And now here we go. I whip out my phone, I press it, and in 3 to 5 minutes, I've got a car. I don't have to worry about money, credit cards. He or she takes me home, and I'm done. Mm. So what you have here is the drivers you can convince, but the users you can't. So part of as well the problem of our platform co-op model, and again, why Brighton is in fact a blessing in disguise that we didn't try and do London first, is how do you convince all of these Londoners that love Uber so much to switch to some other company? Just to get them to think about switching is already a huge effort, costs millions in marketing, So that's this. So the second type of where the producers, because they're in the relation, they're in the kind of the financial work relationship with the platform. They understand the exploitative nature of it. They would like to see something different. You have then the users who really don't. And I would say the same about the Deliveroos, the Uber Eats. Again, customers love them. It's the simplicity. The user experience is great.
So it has to be the same quality. It has to be the same quality of service, doesn't it? It has to be the same.
Yes.
Level.
I mean,
of
that's why also we've spoken a lot that the final product that we launch in Brighton, it should almost be invisible that it's ethical in a platform co-op.
Yeah.
Because actually, again, possibly not in Brighton. Brighton might be an exception, but in general, I think if it wears its ethical credentials too high, people just assume that quality of service or cost are going to be compromised, and either you get a worse quality of service or you're going to pay additional cost.
Yeah,
And I think that's deep within people's kind of mindset at the moment. So in fact, we still have to talk to some marketing experts. But we may actually launch in Brighton with some of that stuff quite far down so that, we want to say we are just as good and quick and at a relatively similar price. And then on top of that, we're building in the governance, the good stuff that, what I think is the real foundation. But that's the whole, luckily we've got marketing people to make those kind of, help us make those kind of decisions because I think it's very important.
So give us a bit of history. How did this the platform co-op movement start?
Well, I think it started, it's just as a reaction to this huge growth in platforms. So, and I think that's another really interesting, if you look 20 years ago, we had none of these really platform companies were in any way near some of the largest companies we have today. Mm. Today, 7 of the top 10 companies in the world by stock market valuation, and again, we can dispute whether that represents real value or not, but 7 of the top 10 are now kind of platform companies. There are 5 of those are US-based and 2 of those are China-based. So the notion of the platform as the place where we go to kind of exchange, procure goods and services has grown exponentially. And what these platforms have also shown themselves to be is very, very exploitative and highly extractive. And you can do that anywhere from, you know, Apple's App Store model, which is also a platform that links app developers with customers. And again, provided a huge kind of new economy. This idea of an app didn't exist, you know, 15 years ago. They created this huge platform, but it's hugely extractive. It took a huge cut of all of these people's time. And you see that across all the different platforms, from the Ubers, and even then the Facebooks and so on, which provide platforms again of a different kind of nature.
And so, and I guess it just makes it makes a tiny number of people extremely rich by you know, taking a little bit of millions of people's work and concentrating it.
Yeah, right? So by creating these, you know, global marketplaces, and indeed that's, you know, the origin of the platform is really the kind of the medieval marketplace. So that's really the first kind of offline platform was the marketplace. So a city or a place would provide a physical space which would allow producers to come and consumers would come at the same time, and they would then collaborate, they would then exchange on this platform, which was a physical platform. And basically what these companies have done is reinvented the marketplace for a digital age, and bringing together these producers. And just as in medieval times, owning the city square gave you control over the city, today owning those digital online marketplaces has proved to be an extremely potent way of extracting value. And you know, there's a lot of good reasons for that. They grow very, very seamlessly. So once you have the physical infrastructure, you can bolt on additional bits very, very easily. And so that's why Uber have been so effective at jumping from city to city. And then coupled with that, the online kind of network effect. So as marketplaces grow, their kind of utility doesn't grow in a linear fashion, but kind of grows in a more kind of exponential fashion, because it creates these networks that, so you have more producers with more customers, you have more chance of linking, of finding the right good. You know, eBay is a great example. If you only had 10 sellers on eBay selling their stuff, it just wouldn't be the place that it is. What's fantastic and amazing about eBay or Amazon or any of these other kind of online digital marketplaces is that it literally has everything. Mm. So they can connect any consumer with the producer. And it, as well, it allows producers who previously would have really struggled to find a market. You can now be a seller of, you know, some really, really niche product, because in fact the whole globe can find you. Mm-hmm. So I think it's as a reaction to some of that, as a reaction to seeing, and especially in the commerce sector, but once they kind of migrated into the working environment where they were really changing the nature of work, I think that's when people really started to wake up and think that, you know, is this the way that we want our platforms to operate? If in the future, you know, as the likes of Uber want to be all of our transportation needs.
Yeah.
They may be
no drivers, just Google driverless cars, and then we're away.
Absolutely. But you know, Uber investing in dockless bikes. They're investing in all sorts of other kind of transport infrastructure. There's a town in America where instead of providing a bus network, they provide a network of Uber vans that intelligently go and pick people up and reroute routes all the time. So these companies have aspirations to be kind of our everything. And I think that's also one of the things that have kind of piqued the notion that what we actually, if we don't get in there now,
it's terrifying. We're
actually too late to find the alternatives. And I think in some senses we already are. So for instance, in London, I don't think it's possible for a platform co-op to emerge in London and be and really work as a, you know, is that real like on-demand transport system?
You're just talking about cabs, though.
Yeah. That for me, that area is just lost in London. So if we want to combat Uber in London, we need to think differently. So for me,
from outside and come in.
Yeah. So I think there's real challenges, and I think it emerged from, as they saw the kind of the the rapacious nature of these, the extractive, and then the exploitative way in which they treat their workers, and the way that they're kind of very poor global citizens, you know, trying to minimize the tax they pay, avoid as much regulation as possible, push as much of the risk onto their precarious workforce. All of these things are an antithesis to what many of us have been fighting for. And so up emerged, and again, at a theoretical level, and I think that's why it's so beautiful, so many of those things are mitigated by enveloping it in the cooperative values. And that's, again, why it was so exciting.
So you said that Nathan Schneider coined the term platform co-op.
When
was this? How did this all start?
It was an article you wrote for Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, which is I think it's a German foundation that they put out some really, really interesting stuff. And it was just that, the kind of narrative about the growth of these platforms and about how what we really need is to merge this notion of values with the power of a platform. And that's where you would get a kind of more just kind of global economy emerging. And, you know, I think it was really spot on a theoretical level. I think what was less clear back then, and for me is only just emerging and kind of additional clarity now, is what it actually takes to make that vision a reality. And I think one of the pictures that's really clear for me is that what you really need, we need the unions on side. So the American examples that have proved successful, either in taxis or cleaning, there's also a nurse's one, have all been successful when the unions have worked together with those who represent to create structures that they need to be. Much more effective as a union to be working practically with your workers to create an entity that's going to respect them and their rights long term and give them real power. And as a union to continually work against companies that you know are continually going to try and minimize rights, restrict pay as much as possible. Yeah. And that's something for me that the UK's unions haven't really got it yet. They are still, and I totally acknowledge that this is important. You have to, the unions are fighting for platforms, and that is important. We need that level playing field, which is also another important criteria for platforms to be able to emerge, is we need a level playing field. So for instance, Uber records all of their revenue in Luxembourg and so pays no VAT. Mm. So if I want to compete, I'm immediately at a 20% disadvantage because I want my company here paying VAT, being a proper corporate citizen.
That's really outrageous, isn't it?
Yeah, you've immediately got a 20% disadvantage. So
it's unbelievable how that is legal.
Absolutely. Well, this may be, not to bring Brexit into every single discussion, this may be a side benefit of Brexit, that these arrangements are horrible because they're not an agreement within a single market, but they would be within from two separate markets. So it may be that one side benefit is that some of these complicated tax structures become less feasible. So obviously there are lots of downsides as well to Brexit, but we don't need to do a Brexit one. But so yes, you absolutely need that level field. So that, the unions have been for the moment really focused on fighting against and for the rights of their workers. But for me, they haven't had the big picture in mind enough, which is that unions with the direct, because they have that direct relationship with all of these workers, are also the perfect entity to be creating the structures that will guarantee respect for their members' rights in the long term, in structures that contribute to the social welfare of the places where they live, that are good corporate citizens, that contribute to the wealth, so everything positive that could emerge from them supporting a platform co-op, which is totally different to fighting against the existing platforms, which I totally acknowledge is a really important thing, because we need that level playing field.
Is the platform co-op movement growing? Is it widespread? Is it in different countries? Is it on the up?
It's definitely growing. So there was the first ever kind of accelerator program for platform co-ops, which was run by Co-ops UK and Stir magazine. And that was a global first. So they took eight nascent platform co-ops in the UK, of which my one was one. and took us through a kind of 12-week program.
And what's yours called?
It was Fair Cab.
Fair Cab.
Yeah. So I think, and you know, that was the first cohort. They're already planning the second cohort. And again, there, you know, the platforms verged from, there was food, there was media, social care, a kind of cohort version of Reddit. There was us in transport. I tried to think of the rest, but so I think people are really trying to figure out how to make these things work. We're at the kind of early experimentation stage. So it's definitely growing. There's definitely a growing amount of interest. But we are going to need, I feel like we're going to need to see some success soon.
Is there anything looking likely in the UK?
Well, the one that I'm most positive about is social care. So the social care co-op. Only because, as I say, it has that dynamic of both people being fed up with the marketplace as it stands, looking for something new. I have you know, timid hopes for my ride hail co-op in Brighton. I think we've got a good chance of making it a success. We need to raise a limited amount of money to make it happen. You know, it's only about, I mean, and it still sounds like a lot of money to me, but about £300,000 or £400,000. You know, we get the tech, we fully launch, we're ready to go, we do some marketing. We think we can raise that money. If we get it going in Brighton, I think there's a, you know, I think there's a good chance of making it work. I think some of the other interesting ones, I mean, one that I'm a member of that I really like is Resonate, which is a Berlin-based one. And that's trying to kind of battle against the Spotify, Apple Music kind of world. And they, again, they're a multi-stakeholder. So me as a listener, I'm a member. But the bands who are on there are also members. The labels are also members. And so they're trying to develop this kind of whole music ecosystem. Again, under a totally different model. And then rather than, you know, so one of the big criticisms about Spotify and Apple Music is that they're totally opaque pricing mechanism. So there's almost no relationship between the number of listens you get and the amount that you see in your bank at the end of a particular month. And that whole, what you get paid is shrouded in complete, it's a complete black box. And so what Resonate have done interestingly, using blockchain technology, so they're using the R chain kind of blockchain, they're making all of the rules and listens totally transparent, so that any artist at any time can query a public ledger and verify that they're being paid the right amount according to really set out rules. So they're just kind of opening up that kind of black boxness of it. Also changing the relationship between listener and user, so that you can actually, the artist that you really like, you end up contributing a bit more to than the ones you don't. You know, it's really, really innovative.
So this is what I wanted to ask. So if there are none based in the UK, are there platform co-ops based outside the UK that people in the UK can use apart from Resonate?
Resonate's the one that I know the best.
Or is there a directory to go to, or is the place? Is there a place that people?
There is a directory. Yes, which I will send to you at the end of this. I don't have the email address off the top of my head, but yes, there's a. I think it's a Canadian organisation which is combining a kind of global list of platform co-op. And that's definitely a good place to look.